Well, good morning. Welcome to the bunker.
Locked in the bunker, shadows shake. One man clapping secrets awake. Board games living, dice they break. Echoes pounding, hearts they quake.
Welcome to the sound of one man clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker. It's Sunday morning, and after a wild dumpster fire of a week, not really, just some hot drama in the OMC household, I'm happy to be here with you. Today, we're going to go through the games that were. I'm going to share everything that's come in with incoming. There are four exclamation marks there, but I'm only on my second coffee, so forgive. I'll take you through what's got my attention in crowdfunding, and then in voices in my head, we're going to talk about what happens when theme and gameplay have a great hot sex fest on my table. On with the show. Well, welcome back to my own personal therapy session, clappers. It's a delight to have you here. Thank you for getting your clipboard and your little couch out and listening to my sultry, dulcet tones while I just vent and thrash about. Oh, so this week, I didn't get to play a lot of games due to some shenanigans by daughters. I had one daughter who was diagnosed with some kind of uber-contagious viral rash and had to be isolated for 4 days. I had one daughter who decided Wednesday was a good day to break her foot in gymnastics. So it's been a week of doctor's visits and hospital visits and x-rays and specialists and orthopedic surgeons and all kinds of tomfuckery. So I played a few games. The games I played, at least, were fantastic. So very early in the week, before shenanigans commenced, played a game of Clank Catacombs. Now, I played this, it was four player, we got the Fox and the Peanut and Lou to the table. Lou doesn't play many games because, you know, she's an adult now and has a full-time job and, you know, is busy being an adult and complaining about being an adult and, you know, adulticizing. But it was great. It was last week, early in the week, we played a four-player game of Clank Catacombs, and I am a huge fan of Clank Catacombs. I like the Clank system. I really like the Clank system. I think it's bags of fun. I think that, yes, there are... So, okay. Let's wind it back. In Clank, Clank's a deck builder. It's a racing game, kind of like Quest for El Dorado, but with a few meatier sort of bits in the cards that you have can do a little... funkier stuff sometimes. There's a lot of intercard play. You've got card types that react to each other. And basically on your turn, you're going to play your five cards. The cards have three different icons on them. Sometimes they have none, in which case you're fucked. But there's a move icon. There's basically a purchase icon for going to the market for cards. And there's a combat icon. And you've got a board. You've got a map. Now, in some of the standard Clank stuff, like Clank in Space and whatnot, that map is it's not a set board per se. You've got four or five pieces that click together and they can be flipped around or whatever, and they create a little bit of asymmetry. In Clank Catacombs instead, you have this emergent dungeon that comes from a stack of tiles. You have four tiles that are your starting tiles. They're hot purpley colored and they sit around the starting position, and then the rest of the tiles have to be explored and come out, which is a really fun little, I guess, adjustment to the Clank system, in that what happens is in Clank, you're trying to get into the dungeon, you're trying to steal an artifact, and you're trying to get out. And if you don't get out before the end of the game being when you get knocked out, you're exhausted by the dragon, you basically can't score. You will score zero. With the exception of if you make it back to sort of a little starting area, if you're within like a stone's throw of the entryway, you will score. Getting out gives you a token in all the Clank games that gives you, you know, a chunk of points. It's usually about 20 points. So you get in, you're moving around the dungeon, and what happens in Clank Catacombs is the artifacts are stacked. So there are multiple different artifacts you have to collect, and you can't score unless you've got an artifact. I mean, well, you can, but you can't win. It's not possible because the artifacts are worth big chunks of points. And they start at 7 and they go up to sort of 20. Now, in a normal game of Clank in Space, or whatever the case is, these are all seated around the board. You kind of know where they are, and naturally the higher value ones are further from the entrance because they encourage you to get further, faster, get your artifact, and try and get back to the entrance before you get kerfucked by everyone else at the table. Because what happens in Clank is you make noise. That's why it's called Clank. And you've got these little cubes. And every time you make noise, which can come from a card or come from a game effect, you've got to drop your cubes basically into this bag of other cubes where they get drawn from at different points in the game. And when those cubes get drawn, if your cube color is drawn, that's a damage. Now, there are ways to heal damage. They're very hard to come by, but there are ways to heal damage. And if your damage gets too high, you are exhausted, you lie down, and you are out for the game. If you are out for the game for any reason, either exhausted or you made it to the exit, every time it comes around to your turn, you draw more cubes from the bag for everyone else. So the escalation at the end of a game of Clank is massive. It's absolutely massive, because if you've got three people out and one person left, that one person gets a turn, and then the other three people are all drawing cubes from the bag. And if you are the last one on the table, you want to be really close to the exit, because the chances of the cubes coming out being yours when no one else is putting cubes in is very high. We played this game of Clank, and the ladies and the girls around the table were like, oh, this is fun. I mean, the Peanut had played Clank before, and she's a big Clank fan. She loves it. And we're going around the table, like, oh, this is fun. And then we got to, like, the last 15% of the game, and the fox had a borderline stress meltdown on her turn, right? Like, she didn't quite flip the table, but we were having a chat, and she's like, look, can you all just shut up? I need to get out, and like sweat on the brow and lose to my left. And when the end game comes, like, these girls like, boo. And the Peanut knows what's coming. She's done this before, and she and I are playing. But when Lou and the Fox got to the sort of the last 10-15%, the sheer concentration and the determination when they're drawing their next hand of cards, because all you need at the end of the game is movement. That's all you need is movement to get out. And they're drawing their hand of cards. And you can tell by the look on their face that, you know, whether they've got enough movement icons to get out or not. And it was a very, very tense last sort of three or four turns, which was fantastic. We all got out, which is quite rare, I think, in Clank for all four players to get out and score. But we all got out. I think the Peanut was out second. She actually, she's got a brain for this stuff. You know, she just seems to get... what kind of card? She had some really great card combos in her deck, and she had some cards that were feeding off each other and giving her great big huzzas of stuff, and we had a great time. Clank Catacombs recently delivered, Direwolf recently delivered on a Clank set of expansions, so that's Clank Underworld, which basically adds ladders to the map at random points that you can climb down into a completely different area. And in the underworld, there's a different market to buy stuff, and there's different tokens and different, like, oof, just tasty stuff. And I've got the Clank cubes, the metal cubes, which are so sexy. They are heavy, heavy, chunky. They're not any bigger, but they feel heavier than they got any right to be at that size, and they're gorgeous. And so, yeah, we played Clank Catacombs. We had a fantastic time. Clank is by Paul Denon. There is an army of artists because the art is fantastic. The art is really fantastic in Clank. Every card's got art. Every tile's got art. There's art everywhere, and it's fabulous. And it's by Direwolf Digital. I don't know why they're called Direwolf Digital when they make a lot of board games, but so there it is. Yeah, so shenanigizing started. I only played two more games. I played them both solo. So the second one is Hercules and the 12 Labors. So Hercules and the 12 Labors is this small box... it's a dice manipulation game, basically, where you are playing Hercules after you've murdered your whole family and you're going through the 12 labors, which is your punishment. It doesn't seem like much, really, for going into a rage and murdering your wife and children. You've got to go, you know, clean some stables and wrestle a bull and whatever. Mythology. Yay. So you're Hercules after having murdered your whole family, and you're going through these 12 labors, and you've got a deck of cards. It's a stacked deck of cards of the 12 labors, and you've got dice. And what you're doing is you're flipping, and there's a lovely little narrative. In between each labor, you've got they're tarot-sized cards. You've got a tarot-sized card that gives you a little narrative of what you're doing, and then you've got a card, sometimes three or four cards that sort of hook up together on the table. And you've got these dice that go on there, on the card, with a certain number of pips on them. So, for example, the first one you're fighting is what's the first Herculean labor? It's a wolf, maybe? I can't even recall. Sorry. And anyway, so you've got this one card, and it's got this gorgeous art, this foiled art of the wolf, and you take a gold die, which is for the ones you've got to... hack down, basically. These are hit point counters. And you lay it on there, and it sits on a 6. And the wolf will say, if you want to damage the wolf, you've got to roll a 3 or a 6. And you've got to get that 6 to 0. And on the card, there's a little path that the die marches through. And every time it marches onto a new spot on the path, something happens. There are icons on the path. Now, Hercules has 2 resources on your Hercules card. One is your health, basically, and one is your divinity. And the health starts at 20 and the divinity starts at 0, and you've got to get the divinity back up to 20 to ascend at the end of the game. If you don't get it up to 20 and defeat the final boss, you can't win. And if your health ever gets to 0, you lose. So basically what happens is the die that's on your labor, which could be slaying a wolf or whatever the case is, it's got to move along this path on the card. And the path on the card will say things like take a damage or take 2 damage, or the wolf heals for 1 or the wolf heals for 2. So you've got to look at the path of the die and think about what you want to do, because you have these other lovely cards in front of you that do special things. So you start with the bow, and the bow allows you to manipulate the die up or down by 1 at the cost of 1 of your health. So it's like an exertion. You're going to exert yourself and you're going to strain that die and you're going to get that. And that's what you start with. That's the only a special power or mitigation you have. So you roll your dice. You're going to roll a 3 or a 6, but you can exert yourself to bump your dice. And then you can only do 1 of each roll. You start with 4 dice and you've got to get 3s and 6s before the gold die gets to the end. It's a lovely little system, because once you defeat or pass your labor, you flip the card over and it's got some bennies. So that it might say heal 2, grab a new die. So you've got 5 dice instead of 4 dice. And then it will have a new manipulation on it. And those manipulations are really tasty. They're really spicy. And by the end of the game, you've got 8 of these cards. I think it's 8 laid out in front of you. You've got 8 different ways to mitigate these dice. But by the end of the game, you are fighting Cerberus, the 3-headed guard dog, to the underworld. So there are 3 gold dice marching along this great, huge thing. It's 4 tarot cards you hook up together, and you're marching through these 3 dice. They all start at 6, and they all need different things. Because by the end of the game, it's not roll a 3 or 6. It's to do a damage, you need a straight of 3. Or you need a 1, 2, 3. Or you need 3 of a kind. Right? So it's a little Yahtzee-ish. But with 8 different ways to manipulate the dice, and the dice manipulations could be you lock a die away and you can't use it, but you get to re-roll all the other dice you want. Or it's you can flip it to the opposite side. So, you know, the 1 goes to a 6. Or you can, there's lots. There's 8 different manipulations, which are really clever. And so you end up with what starts off as quite a simple, well, how am I going to do this? And you end up with a fantastic puzzle at the end of where you're rolling, I think at the end I was rolling 10 dice, and I had 8 different ways to manipulate them. And they're not all manipulations, I should say. Some of these cards, they have a gold spot on them, and they give you something wonderful. So, for example, there's one of them that if you pop a 5 on it, you get to block 2 damage. Right, so you later in the game, you always want to make sure you get a 5 on there somehow, because there's a lot of damage with 2 and 3 dice marching across these cards. There's always damage coming. So if you can get that one loaded with a die, it's a die you can't use to hit the bad guy with or complete your labor, but it's a die that's blocking incoming damage. You've got other gold spots that, for example, if you put a pair on a card, you get 2 heals. There's another one, if you put 2 4s, specifically 4s on it, you get a divinity, because remember that divinity track needs to be pumped. If you don't pump that to 20, doesn't matter if you slay Cerberus at the end, if you don't get your divinity to 20, you can't win. It's a really lovely little box of game. I think it's for people that love solo, it's a wonderful little puzzle. And yeah, it's the same puzzle every time. But what's interesting is when your labor is made of more than one card, which it often is, once you get sort of the first 2 or 3, you've got 2 or 3 of these tarot cards that kind of stitch together on the table and make a larger baddie or a larger labor that you're dealing with, a larger puzzle. When you complete that puzzle, you flip it over and each of the backs of the cards give you a different benefit, a different manipulation or a different gold slot, and that's wonderful. Laying over top of this, you've got like what's called mood cards. It's a deck of, I think, 9 cards. And that is an overlay for the round. So you flip one and it might say enraged. So all your dice get a +1. Now that sounds fabulous, but I flipped enraged on a puzzle where in order to damage the creature I was fighting, I had to put one, I had to have a straight of three, and it had to be 1, 2, 3. So any ones I rolled were immediately twos. And I was like, Jesus Christ, how am I supposed to do this? But what's interesting, well, not so interesting, what's clever is the mood cards don't affect re-rolls. So I thankfully had one of these manipulations where I had to spend a die. So you lose a die from your ability to contribute to the labor, but I could re-roll everything. So I would spend a die and re-roll everything. And then if I had ones there, thankfully, then I could get the 1, 2, 3s. And I had other slots that let me manipulate dice up and down. So if there's a 2, you can knock it down to a 1. It was a tasty little solo puzzle. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's probably going to tap out at about 10 plays for me, I think, because even with the multiple cards, I think it's one of those things that can probably feel a bit samey. You might find yourself reaching for the same benefits every time. But I'll put it in the same box as Under Falling Skies. Under Falling Skies can feel a bit rinse and repeat, but it's about once a year I pull Under Falling Skies out and I play the campaign and I absolutely fucking love it, right? It's one of those things that you put it away, it sits on the shelf, it doesn't take up much space, you pull it out later and you just love every minute. And so that is Hercules and the 12 Labors. That is by Tyler J. Brown. The art's by David Schneider Art. The art is spectacular. It's spectacular, and the game has got gold foiling on all the cards. It's published by Envy Born Games. Thoroughly enjoyed it. The only other game I played was an absolute monstrosity. It was Speakeasy by Vitalis Cerda, which has just delivered following crowdfunding last year, just in time for me to offer up more money for the Library of Alexandria. What's it called? The Library game. It's based on the Library of Alexandria. I think it's called The Great Library. Yeah. So Speakeasy. I love Prohibition era stuff. I mean, Boardwalk Empire is one of my favorite TV shows of all time. I love anything that has to do with Al Capone. I just love that. Peaky Blinders, again, another show that I just adored. And I know that was based in UK and Europe, but they touched on Chicago. They got involved with it a little bit. And that sort of era, I just love that dark, dingy. Not that I'd ever want to live there. I just love the it's almost a mythology at this point of that sort of thing. And if you've been following, you know, OMC for any length of time, you know I'm a bit of a Lacerda whore. I really love his games. I play a lot of them solo. I play them with other people every chance I get. They are hard to table. 100% they're hard to table. You need the right group, the right mood, the right amount of time. But I absolutely love them. Speakeasy is no exception. Speakeasy is far and away the biggest box I've ever seen for a Lacerda game. And I don't think it's half again, at least taller than the next Lacerda game I own. It's taller, almost twice as thick as Lisboa. It's half again taller than Weather Machine. It is a monstrous box. And there's a ton in there. I have a big table. And I think I could fit a 4-player game around here, no problem. But I don't think many people could. And what's really clever is I punched this game out. This is a segue. It's not gameplay. This is design. And when you punch the game, there are these 4 long brown bars that come with it. And there's a little graphic on the punch board. And I'm like, what is this? What are these supposed to be for? And so thank you, BGG, hopped on Board Game Geek. I'm like, what the frick are these 4 little brown bars for? Well, what they're for is your player boards, which are triple layered, because you can slide cards into them, which is so gorgeous, by the way. Oh my God, you've got this home base, you know, your hideout, basically, if you will, of where you sit with your little gang. And there are 4 slots at the top. And, you know, one of them represents a door and 3 of them are little art spaces. And basically what the card you have actions on the top left, and on the top right, they have an icon that represents influence. And so on your turn, you can play a card into one of these slots and you take the actions, and then the influence is showing. And influence helps you send out your family members to guard and keep your places operational when the cops come around. What Eagle Griffin has done is they've provided these 4 bars because they recognize that a lot of people are going to have to take this player dashboard and butt it up against the game board, because the game board is monstrous. The dashboards are monstrous. And if you butt this up against the game board, you can't slide any cards in the top. So this is just a little bumper that you place under your player board, up against the game board that creates almost like a little riser so you can slide your cards in the top. And they've elected not to put a riser on the board permanently because it can warp the player boards, you know, from being there permanently. And I just think it's a really clever bit of game design from a production value point of view. And Eagle Griffin's production is, certainly for Lacerda stuff, is fantastic. I have a teeny tiny complaint with the insert, but, you know, it's a first world problem. There's one tiny aspect of the insert where if you've got the wooden upgrade tokens for the influence shields, two of them don't fit in. It's like the Castles of Burgundy insert where you get a handful of tiles that don't fit in where the goods tiles go because the insert was designed for the cardboard tiles and the wooden tiles are too big. It's, you know, I've got these two shield tiles that just don't fit in. There's other spots. There's other spots to put them, but whatevs. Anyway, Speakeasy. Speakeasy is a delight of a game. I cannot wait to play it multiplayer. I think this is something I'm going to be very pushy with my group. I hope you're listening out there, you lot, because this is a game that I want to table this year. It is spectacular. Now, I've played Scarface 1920, Super Trooper on Scarface 1920, which is another gangster era game, which is also excellent. I really love Scarface. Scarface is fuck you, the game. Speakeasy is, oh, fuck me, the game, right? You fuck yourself. There's no direct, and I guess this would be if I had a complaint about the game, which I don't. It's not a complaint. It's not even a criticism. It's just something that I'm noting for all of you out there listening, because, you know, OMC is not a review platform. I talk, you listen sometimes. I'm not here to do reviews. There's no player-to-player conflict in Speakeasy. Now, for something that's based on Prohibition era, where it was all Tommy guns and Molotov cocktails, there's no player-to-player conflict whatsoever in this game. Absolutely none. There's interaction in as much that you are racing. There are rum runner boats, and every time someone goes and attacks the rum runner boat, that rum runner boat gets harder to attack. And there are really tasty resources, not just rum. There's these crates you get, and the crates have huzzah stuff on them and really fantastic bennies for the game. You're also racing for real estate. So when you seed the board, you've got mobsters out there, other mobsters, not player mobsters, like NPC mobsters seeding the board. And you can kind of roll them and take their space. But once you're in, other players can't roll you and kick you out. So not only like Scarface 1920, everything's up for grabs, right? It's like, I've got a card that says I can just fuck you over and over and over again every turn. I'm like, okay, no problem. I've got a special power that says I can lean you over the table and just take care of business. And that's the game. I don't mean to be crass, but it really is the game. Like, you've got to just buy into the, I'm going to get fucked. I have a plan and that plan is fucking useless because I'm going to get so fucked. Speakeasy is a Lacerda game, so it is a Euro, 100% Euro, but it is absolutely oozing with theme. And I'm going to come back to this, I'm going to circle back to this in Voices in My Head, because in Voices in My Head, I want to talk about what happens when theme and gameplay really fuse in a magnificent package. I think Speakeasy has the potential to be my favorite Lacerda. I played it solo, and the solo bot for Speakeasy is not just the smoothest, easiest bot I've ever seen in a Lacerda. It would be one of my top five bots, like up there with Anachrony. If you played Anachrony solo, and you know how great the Chronobot is for Anachrony, this is even easier. This is even easier because you're basically flipping a card and the bot's going to send one of their workers out to a place on the board. And they don't do what's on the board. They do what's on the card. The card has between one and four different actions on it. And they're really easy, right? You just follow those. My turns were taking like 10 minutes, maybe. And don't get me wrong. I wouldn't take 10 minutes if I was playing multiplayer, right? It would probably be 2.5 minutes, maybe 3 minutes. But I was taking 10 or 12 minutes. It's also my first game, right? But the bot turn was like 35 seconds. And when I'm playing a solo Euro, that's what I love, is when the bot is just like, bam, 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 move on, right? Like Gaia Project. Gaia Project's solo is fantastic. You flip two cards, they line up, you go, spoop, bam, 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 that's what I'm doing, and you move on. The bot for Speakeasy is spectacular. The bot has a deck of cards that have locations in them, and if you need to identify a location for certain things, you flip those. And the other one, the other deck cards, is, and it's a staggered deck, so Act 1 has certain cards in it, Act 2 has certain cards in it, Act 3 has certain cards in it, and you can stack that based on your desired difficulty. I was playing on easy. I was playing on easy first game. I did win. I don't usually win the first time I play a solo like this. I did win, and I don't think I cheated. I'll go back and read the rule book, but I think I did pretty well with this. It is fantastic. It's basically a worker placement game. You put a worker out, you do the actions. It's not complicated to learn. Once you learn what the worker spots do, and once you learn how to win, when I say how to win, how to generate points, it's not a difficult game to teach. It's not a difficult game to play. But man, it is crunchy. Like crunchy, 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 crunchy. Like if I was going to play this with Dustin, I would need to be settling in for a 4-hour session, right? Which, to be honest, I think I'd love to play this with Dustin because I want to see what he does with it. But yeah, I want to have a coffee and I want to have, you know, maybe I'm punching a game on the side or something, right? It's just that way. I think, and this is just a gut feeling, this is a game that's going to absolutely shine at 3 players. 2 players, you block off part of the board, which is fine. It's a randomizer for blocking off part of the board. But this, the fight for real estate in this game is real, you know, and that's something that if you don't fight and claim some real estate early, you have no hope. So yeah, Speakeasy. I will talk about this a little bit further later in the pod, but that is by Vitaly Cerda, art by Ian O'Toole. Ian O'Toole has, of course, done a fantastic job. I think the iconography in this is amazing. I had a little bit of alarm because Eagle Griffin posted a note saying, oh, there's 3 errata in the game. And I'm like, what? Since when is there errata in an Eagle Griffin game? Like they test and they check their stuff to death. And people are like, oh, we're going to get a new board. I paid all this money. I want a new board. Once you actually learn how to play the game, the errata is, it's not even errata. What's happened is there's a single circumstance in one of the worker placement games, which is unique in the game. And there's no icon for that circumstance. And so they've used an icon to represent something. It's so meaningless. It's just so, so meaningless. And one of the crate tiles has errata on it, in that the errata is on the reference in the rule book. And when they're showing the crate as an example, not on the crate itself. It's so minor. It's like, oh my God, does it, like the gameplay. So guys, if you like heavy games and you have not played a Lacerda, this is actually, I think, probably one of the best to jump into. It's up there with like the Gallerist or Vinyos with that ease of entry, but it is wild ride. I loved every minute of it. Thank you. Oh, and not so much a game, but I have 10 bazillion unpainted minis in the bunker, and Super Trooper and I had a day of Aeon Trespass planned for this week, past weekend, which of course couldn't happen because I had a daughter in isolation for viral infection. So I was painting the Nietzschean model, which is the one of the big baddies we're due to fight, where it's next up, and I thought, oh, I'll paint the Nietzschean. And he's this big, monstrous thing, and I painted it and he looked glorious. I took a photo and I sent it to Super Trooper and he went, it's the wrong color, bro. I'm like, oh, could fuck off. Like, what? So not only did I paint a mini for the first time in 3 months, I painted it twice. But it does look good. I must say, it does look good. And when I put it up next to the lore in the books now, it matchy-matchies. I could have left it, but I couldn't have left it. So anyway, painted the Nietzschean. There's a game. Sorta. Those are the games that were. And in coming this week, I had 4 things arrive, as you do. I have IR Children of the Sun, which is the spiritual threequel to Sancori and Marco Polo. I think it's Marco Polo. I might have the right, but Sancori and Marco Polo. And this is something that's going to come up in a future podcast. I was able to get this from Amazon UK for $60 less than pre-ordering it here in Australia, which is just stupid, right? It's like stupid to get it that much cheaper. Kinfire Delph is a game that I've been eyeing off as a solo game. It's a small box solo game. It's been out of stock in Australia for quite some time. It's like $30 for the box. And so I thought I'll get one of those. I got Vainglory's Grotto, I believe it's called. So I'm very much looking forward to that. Everdell Duo has been on my list since I got to test it out at PAX this year, because I think the Fox will like that very, very much. She's not a massive fan of Everdell. She'll play it. She'll play Everdell. But she's not a huge fan because it's just too tight. Everdell Duo is a little bit looser and also has a co-op mode with a little mini campaign. So that'll be a lot of fun. And I managed to get my hands on the Zombicide Paris campaign for a very good price. And that, again, has been hard to find in Australia. And I picked that up and that's on the shelf. And that has some unique mechanics in it. I'm very looking forward to getting to the table. I've got some time off coming up at Christmas. So aside from trying to smash out and absolutely kill Cycle 2 of Aeon Trespass with Super Trooper, I'll probably get some Zombicide to the table. The Peanut's quite a fan of Zombicide, so we might try one of those little campaigns. That's it for incoming. And aside, I've got two nice, tasty campaigns, crowdfunding campaigns, that I'm wildly hopeful will be here before my Christmas break. So we'll see. Fingers crossed on that. Other than that, it's going to be very dry for incoming, as it is in January. Obviously, we go into Chinese New Year, I think is late January from memory. And so everything shuts down. And if it's not on the water before Chinese New Year, you're not going to see it until February, March at the earliest. So that's it. That's it for incoming. I hope you guys have got the Fat Man coming with some good stuff for you. Welcome to FOMO Mofo, where I take you through my personal, angst-ridden journey of capitalist acquisitionism. This is not only not an exhaustive list of crowdfunding projects, it is a very small list of crowdfunding projects. In fact, it is a crowdfunding list of one, with one other game ordered that I'm kind of lumping in with crowdfunding. And yeah, the usual. This is just games that are for me, by design and development team I like, a theme I enjoy, or because they have pretty toys. And here we go. So the first one I want to talk about is Witcher Legacy. I like The Witcher. I played Witcher 3 The Wild Hunt, and I thought it was an exceptional game. I haven't read the books, and I probably should, because I classify myself as a fantasy nerd, and it's a set of books that I have not read. I'm currently reading the Mistborn series by Brandon Sanderson, which I am thoroughly enjoying. And I probably should read these books. I'll put them on the list. But The Witcher Legacy, I was vaguely interested based on the hype, and oh man, is there hype around this game. It's currently sitting at 3.3 million euros, and I think there's 16 or 18 days left in the campaign. It's Witcher. If you like Witcher, there's Witcher stuff here. There's lots of Witcher stuff. This is by the company, the game design company that did the previous Witcher game, Witcher Old World. They've also done Cyberpunk 2077. So they kind of have chosen to specialize in video game IPs. I never played Witcher Old World. I didn't have any interest in the gameplay loop. I looked at it when it was on crowdfunding. I thought, no, it's not for me. This is more of that. And I think it looks like there's a good game there. And I think particularly for solo, it looks like there's a good game there. It's just, I have got a lot of games in this sort of niche, and they're calling it Witcher Legacy. I've had a look at it. It kind of looks more like Witcher the campaign than Witcher Legacy. It's, potato, potato. Although, who really fucking says potato? If you know anyone that says potato, can you just punch them in the throat for me, please? Potato. Right? No one says potato, do they? Do any of you say potato? I'm sorry if you do. I will never punch you in the throat, but I will ridicule you mercilessly if we ever meet. Anyway, Witcher Legacy, Witcher campaign. I don't know what the all-in is going to be. I don't know how hard they're going to be pumping that milking machine for the next 16 days. The core deluxe version is just under $300 Australian, which for the amount of game that it appears to have, look, I would say in this market, in this day and age, 2025 and post-tariffs and Captain Cheeto doing his worst, it's probably worth it. Like, it looks like $300 worth of game. $300 in game is sometimes not a lot of game these days, and I think there's a lot there for it. Delivery to Australia is just under $50, so it's about 17%. There's a lot there. If you like Witcher, if you're really in love with the Witcher IP, I think this would be a no-brainer. I wouldn't say I'm ambivalent on it. I like it. I enjoyed the video game. I don't feel the need, like I did with Elder Scrolls, to get a board game port. Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era is like Skyrim, the game, and I don't feel that same drive and need. But if you like Witcher, I think this would be a no-brainer. It is going gangbusters, 3.3 million euros, something like $5 million Australian, which is just a huge amount of money. And good luck to them. It's ultimately a no from me, but yeah, Witcher. And there is nothing else on crowdfunding that I have got going on right now. I have gone all in for Aridia, The Path We Dare Tread, because I think that's going to be an absolutely fantastic experience. And Cody Miller is a legend of a human being, and I want to support the things he does. The only other thing I've currently backed for is the next Lacerda game, because, you know, Lacerda, and I'm a junkie for that stuff. But the other thing I did order, and I'm lumping this in with FOMO Mofo, is Chip Theory Games on Black Friday released their 20 Strong Rose deck. So if you know anything about 20 Strong, it's a single system that Chip Theory designed with 20 dice and one chip. There's one chip for the game. And there's decks of cards. And each deck of cards plays completely differently to the other decks of cards. So their most recent campaign was called Tanglewoods, which was, all the art was done by Manny Tremblay, which is fantastic. It's got, I mean, you see it, you know it's Manny Tremblay, right? And that's one of the things I love. You see Ian O'Toole's art, you know it's him. You see Vincent Dutre, you know it's him. You see Manny Tremblay, you know it's him. He's got a style and he sticks to it, and it's beautiful. And the Tanglewoods decks were based on fairy tales. So you've got red, which is Little Red Riding Hood, so you're fighting the Big Bad Wolf, and you've got white, which is Snow White, and you've got the witch, and the dwarves are all playing in, and you've got gold, which is Goldilocks. And so Rose is basically the Beauty and the Beast deck. And I haven't played any of them yet. They're sitting here. I just obviously haven't had time this week. But I pre-ordered 20 Strong Rose so that I can, one, add that to my vault of 20 Strong decks and have more experiences with it. But two, I really like what Chip Theory does. I like their games. I don't think I've ever played a game of theirs that I have not enjoyed. I haven't played Triplock because I don't like memory games. I am not a big fan of just having to memorize shit for fun. And Triplock looks like it's a memory game. But I am a little bit of a Chip Theory junkie. I've got most of their output here in the bunker. And most of their output, well, all of the output that I have is very much geared towards solo players. You know, Cloudspire has a fantastic solo mode. Too Many Bones is as a solo game is a triumph. Burn Cycle is, I maintain solely that Burn Cycle is a solo game. It's not a multiplayer game. Despite being sold as a, I think, 1-4 experience, it is 100% a solo game. And it's wonderful. Burn Cycle is a wonderful puzzle. And the 20 Strong decks that I've played to date are fantastic. So, more 20 Strong. 20 Strong Rose. It's got an interesting story behind it. I think it was a game they designed for, it was either Hasbro or one of those, or Target. And it was going to be their first mass market game, you know, going into something like a Target. And something happened, and it was all designed and all developed, and it was meant to release at the same time as 20 Strong, but be at Target or Walmart, one of those. I might have the details wrong. And for whatever reason, the whole project and relationship fell through. And so they've released it on their site as of Black Friday. I think it was $19.99 American, so it was $462 Australian. It's on its way, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. And that is it for FOMO Mofo, probably for the year. I know there's other campaigns coming. But that's probably, I want to say it's December tomorrow. So surely that's it. Oh, it's a quick therapy session this week, guys. You know, with Christmas coming, we're all busy. I've got stuff to do. It's Sunday. It's, you know, 7:30 in the morning. I've got things I got to get to later on today, but you know, this is for me. I do it for me and I love it. So voices in my head, what we're going to talk about today is when theme and gameplay have a massive hot love fest. You know, I love a gameplay theme. I love when games are themed, even if that theme is really just a skin. You know, Wonderlands War is one of my favorite games, and I think it's more theme than game. I think it walks that fine line between quite well, but it's got that, it's a little bit like Quacks of Quedlinburg Plus. You know, Super Trooper maintains that Quacks is not a game. It's not, you know, it's you draw a chip and you keep drawing chips, or you don't. I mean, it's like Flip 7, the potion game, and my family loves Quacks, and I love playing Quacks with my family. I don't necessarily disagree with Super Trooper on that one, but I kind of do. I like Quacks. I think Quacks is fun for what it is. It's, as I said, It's basically Flip 7 with a bag, is all it is. And it, you know, it's got a little bit of drama, a little bit of giggling, a little bit of squealing. Wonderland's War is like Quacks plus plus. It's got just a little bit more. You got a little more agency. But it is definitely more theme than game. I don't have a lot in the bunker that is more theme than game. But I certainly have some stuff that leans into theme quite heavily. I do have a lot that's on the other side where it's more gameplay than theme. Because I love me a heavy Euro. You know, but let's talk about Gaia Project. Gaia Project is a fantastic game. I haven't played Gaia Project in like 2 years. I should really play Gaia Project. Gaia Project could be anything. Hence why there's Terra Mystica and... what's the other one? You can skin it with anything. And it's just tokens. It's just tokens going out with rules for tokens. It is fantastic. It's a fantastic game. But Gaia Project is basically tokens in space. You know, Scholars of the South Tigris, which I love, where you're ostensibly, you know, translating scrolls. I mean, you're not. It's really complicated recipe fulfillment is all it is, right? With colored dice. You've got color recipes. You've got tracks to go up. But really, the tracks are just about getting you more resources to fulfill recipes. It's just a recipe fulfillment game, right? You're trying to get those recipes fulfilled in front of you because they will give you points at the end. It could be a cooking game. Just as easily. It could be, I mean, the theme is really pointless. That said, I freaking love Scholars of the South Tigris. I should play Scholars again. Super Trooper, we should play Scholars again. I know Super Trooper's a fan too. Scholars, amazing game. Shackleton Base, another amazing game. I love Shackleton Base. The board, when you first look at it, it has that smartphone ink look about it where it's, really? What am I looking at here? Is this even a game? It's just... a big white circle with spots to put stuff in. It's a game. It's a great game. But the theme, I mean, God, it could be anything. We could be setting a dinner table. I mean, God, it could be anything. We could be getting out forks and knives. Wouldn't that be boring? But it's the same game. It'd be boring. Anything by Dr. Knizia. There's some Reiner Knizia games that I really, really like. But, oh, man, they could just be anything. In fact, they are. I think he's got 900 games published. It's probably only 300 games there, and they've just been Frankenstein together in other games and reskinned. And look, I'm not complaining. There's 900 Reiner Knizia games we can play. So many of them are, and even the ones that are fantastic and evergreens, like Ra. Ra could be anything, right? You're pulling tiles, and you're deciding if it matches what you're looking for. It could be rainbow colors. Like, oh, I need a set of the rainbow, and now I need a set of blues. Now I need a set of reds. Now I need a red. It could be anything. Happens to be Egyptian theme. That's great. It's really cool. It's a fun game. Ra is a fun game. But man, don't tell me that Reiner Knizia does theme, because I don't think so. I'm wrong all the time. And anyway, that's not to say they're not great games. What I want to talk about is when a game smashes theme and smashes gameplay. And this come about in part because of Speakeasy, you know, this last week. Speakeasy, circling back to it, you are basically bootleggers and you're trying to get alcohol out. And in order to do that, you need to first, you don't have to do it first, but you got to do it at some point. You've got to build a still. You've got to build stills that are going to pump alcohol out. And you've got some tracks that make your stuff more powerful. Because once you've got stills, you've got to have trucks. And the trucks have to get the alcohol out to your speakeasies. Now, speakeasies are where you are selling the rum after you've made it at your stills. You can also build, and you don't have to, but you can also build nightclubs and casinos, because nightclubs and casinos can charge more for your alcohol. Speakeasy is this dingy little cellar somewhere where people are coming in and they're throwing a few coins for a drink. Well, you go to the nightclub where people are dancing, there's music, go to the casino where people are gambling, you can charge more. So if you want more money, because money's points in Speakeasy, you have got to... you've got to build the bigger buildings. So you've got to try and look at the map and you've got to get your still somewhere, ideally pretty central, where there's no cops yet. Because if there's cops in an area where you have a building, if you don't have a family member there protecting the building is what's called, is non-operational, which in the rule book says basically consider a non-operational building. It just doesn't freaking exist. If you have a building that doesn't have a family member next to it, somebody from your little group of bootleggers, the building does nothing. It doesn't score, it doesn't make alcohol, it doesn't sell alcohol, it doesn't do any of that. So you've got to get the alcohol made, and you've got to get it shipped out, and then you've got to sell it. And look, it's a game called Speakeasy. There are also boats that travel all around Manhattan, and those boats are run by the likes of Al Capone and Arnold Rothstein and that sort of thing. And you can, if you happen to be in a sector, in a district where there's a boat, you can buy the rum straight off the boat. You can hijack the boat, and that comes with certain needs. If you buy the rum, you get the rum. Rum gets more expensive off the boat. If you hijack the boat, you get the rum for free. Rum still gets more expensive because there's less rum on the boat, and you get a crate of goodies. On top of that, you've got money in front of you, but it's in two piles. You've got money that's in front of your screen, which you can spend, and you got money behind your screen, which you can also spend, but that's your illicit money. If you want to spend illicit money, it's got to be laundered. So if something costs $10 for you, you've got to spend $20 out of your illicit funds because it's got to be laundered. And I just think that is so clever. Money being points, you want to be really careful about how much of the stuff you spend from behind the screen. It is zesty, and it all pulls in. And it's a game where it's like in Kanban, which I kind of bounced off, and Kanban is a very loved game, and I can see why. But in Kanban, it's like, well, I go to a department, and in that department, I'm going to get a voucher. And then that voucher, I go to another department, then I'm going to get parts. But not if there might not be the parts I want there. And if there aren't, well, I can take the parts and I can exchange them at another parts place. Well, why can't I just get the parts if I can exchange them? So then I'm going to go to another spot on the board to exchange the parts for the parts I need. And then once those are done, maybe I can build a car if the right recipe is in front of me. Look, it's a Lacerda. Don't get me wrong, it's a Lacerda. And Weather Machine has a little bit of that as well. But I think it's just a little less Kanban-y, the Weather Machine. It may be that the theme for Weather Machine really gets me, that sort of diesel punk bit on Weather Machine. I really like the art on it. Speakeasy, all the bits fit together. Everything you're doing makes sense. And it reminded me a lot of Galactic Cruise, which is another one from the last, 12 to 13 months. I can't remember how long ago I got Galactic Cruise. I feel like it was maybe this time last year. And I've got 5 or 6 plays of Galactic Cruise under my belt. Galactic Cruise is another one where you've got this beautiful board and you've got these beautiful player pieces and everything makes sense. You've got to build your ships. And so you've got to buy the blueprints and then you've got to build the ships. You don't have to get supplies, you don't have to get steel and titanium and all that garbage, but you've got to buy the blueprints, then you've got to build them. That's one. You've got to advertise the cruise. That's two. You've got to schedule a cruise. There's three. You've got to have fuel and food and oxygen. That's four. And then you launch a cruise. And the cruise goes through a little cycle and it does things that bring things back for you, right? And if you've got to have the right people on the cruise, because if it's a cruise going to a family fun destination, well, you want families on there. And if it's going to an adventure destination, you want adventure people on there. I think Galactic Cruise, this is a first game by Kinson Key Games. It is an absolute triumph of gaming that manages to take theme and gameplay and smash it together and make you feel at least a little bit like you're running a cruise company. It could have been a ship cruise. They could have put anything else on there, really. I think, but it... Look, I think that the Speakeasies of the world, the Galactic Cruises of the world, when they get it right and they push those two things together, and it's hard. It's got to be hard, particularly because Euros all... I'm not going to try and define a Euro, but really, Euros are all about resource management in the end. And in Speakeasy, your resource is money. You're just trying to manage money, which if you are a bootlegger, that is, you live and die on money. You've got people that you're managing, but in the end, they all cost money. You've got rum and it's money. You've got to build things and it's money. It's money. Money is points. Galactic Cruise is points. So it's like, okay, well, you got points, you got to get, but you get more points for longer cruises. You get more points if your cruise matches the people that are on it. And if you're running a business and you've marketed to the wrong people, then of course you're going to make less money. And I think it's a delight. You could talk about something like Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era, which is a chip theory game, and it is the single heaviest box I have ever hoisted in my existence. It is partly because chip theory games are already heavy, they're all plastic and whatnot. But in Elder Scrolls, you really feel like you're playing a Skyrim or an Oblivion or a Morrowind. One, they've got the art absolutely nailed, and I know that was one of the challenges they had when they were working through this game with Bethesda, is making sure that the art was all absolutely approved right down to each brushstroke. And the art feels like an Elder Scrolls game. The gameplay loop feels like an Elder Scrolls game. You know, you're going from city to city, and you have different options to buy stuff because you've got specialized merchants and you've got specialized trainers. And, you know, and if you've ever played Skyrim, you know you're always going to Riften because that's where the Dark Brotherhood is. And if you know, it was just so tasty, and it all came together, and you feel like you're playing a true Elder Scrolls game. They have managed to capture the aesthetic. They've managed to capture the gameplay, and they've smashed it together into something that I can tell you right now will never leave my collection. And I love a theme game. I like Quacksequedlinburg. I love Wonderland's War. I like a gameplay game. You know, you've got Underwater Cities, which is a Vladimir Suki game where you're building underwater cities. Why? Well, because, you know, Armageddon, whatever, who knows. But it is really just, here's four different resources, and you're just going to paint yourself into a corner for 2 hours. It's delicious. The theme is, okay, you've got little plastic domes you're popping out, you've got little kelp farms and whatever the case is. But the theme could be anything. But the game is amazing. It's a wonderful, wonderful game. You know, you've got Through the Desert. It's got a Reiner Knizia game. I don't own Through the Desert. I've played Through the Desert a few times. You're putting camels out. It could be anything. It's basically a positional abstract. You know, it could be cubes. It's cubes. If cubes would be easier to play, I think, because the camels and the riders don't match, and it fucks my tiny little brain up all the time, and I end up putting a pink camel where I can't put a pink camel or shouldn't put a pink camel. And look, Through the Desert, it's fine. It's a good game. I will say I enjoy it enough. I could play a gameplay game, I could play a theme game, but when they get it right, my little toy-riddled brain just fucking loves that shit. I don't know if that's of interest to anybody, but I feel good. Happy Sunday, OMC crew. Oh, you can find me on all the socials. You can find me on Facebook by searching One Man Clapping. Thank you to Super Trooper for now being part of the One Man Clapping social media management team. You'll see posts from time to time that say ST on them, or H, that's Super Trooper, or Hamez, you know who you're talking to. You can email me at onemanclapping, that's WONmanclapping@gmail.com, as in I won all the games, which I don't. I'm on Instagram. We're on Instagram. You can join the One Man Clapping Guild on BGG. Subscribe to Guild 4426. And you can help OMC by dropping us a like on Facebook or Instagram, or a review on whatever platform you choose. Thank you, as always, for your time. Your time is precious. And the fact that you chose to waste an hour of it listening to how I spend my time is always humbling. Till next time, get your game on, even if you've got to play with yourself. After all, it's Christmas. Peace out, mofos. Locked in the bunker, shadow.